Yo, 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 what up? It's your boy Kobe Mack, and this is Kobe Told Me About. Yo, whenever I want to interview pod where I get to chop it up with a who's who of the dopest individuals I know, and hopefully some I'm getting to know a little bit better. Just a kickback conversation about life, movies, and how they intersect all together for your listening pleasure. Would you please consider giving your boy a follow? I'm on all the socials at Kobe Told Me on Twitter and Instagram, and on Facebook at Kobe Mack. Welcome, welcome, welcome back. And let me tell you about Rosa of Rosa's Reviews. You can go ahead and follow her at Rosa's Reviews on Twitter. She is the founder of the Latinx Lens at Latinx Lens. It's a brand new podcast going to be dropping soon where there's two Latinas discussing Latinx representation and contributions to the film industry. She is also an editor for In Their Own League, a really cool podcast at their league and website. In Their Own League is a website and podcast dedicated to celebrating female filmmakers and other underrepresented talent working in the film industry. And of course, Rosa, you can make sure to follow all of her work at her website at rosasreviews.net. Without further ado, Rosa. ¿Cómo está, girl?
Hey!
Yo, y'all do not understand how monumentous this occasion is for me. One, Rosa is one of the first people that ever followed me on Twitter. And like legit, my journey started back in like November of 2018. It is now, let me look at my naked hand. Yeah, my naked wrist says it is April of 2020 that I've known this young woman. And she's been super supportive, always had my back, hella engaging, just like loads of positivity. And this is the first time that I'm having a conversation with her, vocal exchangeably, like ever. And like, I call you a friend. Thank you for coming on.
No, thank you for inviting me. I'm really honored, and this is such a pleasure to be here because you were one of the first people to ever comment on my blog, on one of my reviews, and you comment, and then it went on from there. I ended up following you on social media and so on, and now we're here, and you were one of the first people to embrace me, to support me, to encourage me, and truly, you are a friend that I really, really, really admire, and I could not be luckier to be here, because you're just amazing, and I owe a lot of everything I'm doing right now. A lot has to do with you, with your encouragement and your support, so thank you for inviting me.
Yo, my heart is so full right now. Oh my gosh, like it's cool. One, not only that, where you were the first people to support, and then vice versa, we supported each other, but like, you're the first person to ever grace my podcast. This has been the only voice on Kobe Told Me, and I'm glad that you can be able to share the mic with me, because like, if everybody knows, I am so not technical, and like, I took baby steps to learn how to fucking edit. And it's finally happened. It's finally happened. And I'm going to get you like a jersey to be like, yo, my first guest, or like a t-shirt or something. And like, I just wanted to start this interview series because like, one, we've got a lot of time on our hands. But also like, there's so many folks who I engage with on a daily basis who like, I'm very interested in like, you know, I listen to so many podcasts, right? And I never make an attempt to try to find like their episode zero or like going through their back catalog. And like, granted, I've been, you know, a subscriber to your blog for a long time. Yo, you write, you impress the hell out of me with how consistent you are with writing. And I like right now, I have the biggest block. Like, I haven't written a full review in months. And it's not because I can't, I get in my own way. I get easily distracted and procrastinate. How do you do? How do you keep up with everything you got going on? How are you so consistent with your writing?
Oh my. That's a really good question. I don't know. I just don't know. I just do it, I guess. I'm not going to say I'm a perfectionist, but I do always push myself, and I always set myself some datelines. I always have those Also, actually, a lot has to do with being a member of so many societies and associations, and they have these requirements where you have to write a certain number of reviews, either monthly or per a period of time. And I'm very hard on myself, and I try to have a little bit more than what they require just so I can continue to be a member of these societies and such, and to just put out work, like put my voice out there and just give my thoughts and opinions. And another thing, I love watching movies, and I love talking about them, and I just like writing reviews, so that also motivates me, just the love of film.
And it's just like it's obviously you found something that you got a knack for. How did you know, like, I think we all kind of love movies, right? When did you know that you wanted to talk about them in, like, a professional manner?
Oh, professional manner. Let me see. It's actually been quite recently. It hasn't been that long. It was when I watched Wonder Woman.
Really?
I'm telling you, it's pretty recent. I watched Wonder Woman. I really enjoyed the movie. And even prior to then, I was keeping up with the newly released films, and until Wonder Woman came out, and I started to watch these videos on reviews on the movie. I started to read some articles on it, started to read some of the Rotten Tomato reviews on it, and I couldn't understand. I wasn't very much familiarized with the film industry and filmmaking and such. I didn't understand why it was such a big deal. Why Wonder Woman was a big deal at all. Until I realized it was the first ever female superhero on screen. The film was directed by a woman. And you were seeing this film through a different lens. And it was then that I realized, okay, interesting. This kind of piqued my interest. And I was just given a little advice. Somebody, one of my friends, just randomly told me, hey, you know what? You watch a lot of movies. Why not just put a Instagram page on your movies and just give your 1-2 sentences on the film and say if you recommend people watching it or not? And then everything just evolved from there. But Wonder Woman was the film that triggered that little instinct in me.
Yo, that's like a really good start. Because
Wonder
Woman is my number one, like, DCEU movie. It's so impressive, the fact that it took forever for it to happen. And then the way that it happened, and coming off the back of, like, Batman v Superman, which was a complicated film in regards to reception. I personally love it. But a lot of people did it. But the best thing that came out of that was Gal Gadot's performance, you know, as Wonder Woman. And then seeing how Patty Jenkins took that and then made this phenomenal film that I never imagined, like, Wonder Woman. Like, Wonder Woman was so American, I never imagined her anything else. And seeing that translation and handoff between what Zach did and what Patty did, like, it must be, like, super dope that was, like, your first to kind of, like, not that it inspired you, but just, like, you thought that you can do it. And the fact that you did research trying to understand, like, why. And you have the benefit of living in my opinion, the second greatest city in all of the world, in Los Angeles. Like, you've got this
second.
Well, yo, number one is New York City. Like, hands down, the best city in the world. Have you been to New York?
I have not.
You know, so see, that's the thing, you don't know just yet. But like,
that's very true.
I promise you. Having lived in Los Angeles on and off, you know, over the past, like, well, not the past 5 years, but for 5 years, LA's great. Now, granted, now tell me something. Were you born and raised in LA?
East LA, yeah.
So like, maybe you kind of see it a little bit differently. When I got to Los Angeles, I was like, I don't know. It's so bizarre, the different worlds that are at work there. Like, one, it's this huge playground for film and TV, which that was my draw, right? Graduated high school in 2005, and like I said, yo, I'm gonna go do the actor thing. No, you shouldn't, you're gonna die, blah, 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 blah. Nah, son. I went out there, my literal second day that I was in Los Angeles, I got my first production job. I was a PA working on a really weird feature film. It was an indie feature that I think was a cult, But they paid me in cash. It was like $250. So, like, I'm going to take that. My second day out there, I got my first gig. And I did pretty well for myself. A lot of indie stuff, some background stuff, some, like, featured stuff. But, like, I love that sandbox. And it's in your backyard. So, like, you get access to everything. How has it been being so close to what you talk about?
Oh, I think it still has not sunk in yet, to be honest. I think it's little by little it's sinking in. The more I'm on social media and the more I experience having the access to smaller films, due to the smaller theaters around the city and such, and then also where I work has a lot to do with it as well.
Speaking of which, guys,
yeah,
there's a scientist on the podcast and it ain't me.
Oh,
so please, because I think that is so unique. When I found that out, like, my jaw dropped. I'm like, yo, not only is she a bomb ass writer, but, like, she's a fucking scientist. So please tell the people your day job.
Yes, of course. I work at Cedar Sinai Medical Center. A lot of people know, hopefully a lot of people know.
I think, isn't that like the most famous hospital in Los Angeles?
I think it is, yeah.
You know the movie that comes to mind where they can Cedar Sinai is fucking Volcano with Tommy Lee Jones.
I need to rewatch that film.
You know, that is, like, I mean, I don't know why, since I've been inside of, like, dealing with the coronavirus, I'm watching, like, so many disaster films. Like, I was watching the other night. I watched Deep Impact last night. And I'm like, yo, I really want to watch Volcano. I watched it so many times, and I thought it was so cool. And they say the name Cedar Sinai so much. So, like, that's a really important hospital.
Yes, I think it is. I need to watch that film, too. I've also been watching a lot of disaster films. But that's for a whole different little project we have coming up. We're doing like a top 5 disaster films of all time.
Okay.
So I've been trying to build up my repertoire.
Let's hope there's no disaster at your place of work, which I believe you're still, you got the job holding it down, everything amidst everything, right?
Yeah. I'm one of the few people who still goes to work. I see it as now that I think about it, I think I'm one of the few lucky people that still goes to work, because I'm partially sane because of it. And I don't have to stay home 24/7 and such. So I am one of the few lucky ones to get to work, but it's a bit stressful. Because I work in a laboratory, I work in an anatomic pathology, so I'm an electron microscopist. So what I do, pretty much, just to put it simply, when people go get biopsies done, they come to me, I preserve the tissue, I cut it, I stain it, and then I give it to pathologists for them to make a diagnosis, prognosis. And from there, I'm very lucky, very, very lucky that I get to work at Cedars-Sinai, because they, not only are they one of the most prestigious hospitals and institutions, like, nationwide, but they are very supportive, and everything they're doing right now is amazing, not only towards the patients and helping patients recuperate from this, the virus, but towards us. A lot of the healthcare providers are getting, recognized, and they're getting applauded and so on and so forth. But to me, the hospital itself has done a lot for us, and I'm very lucky, and it does not pass my mind that I'm aware, and I know how privileged and how lucky I am to still have a job. And even though I'm working a reduced number of hours, I'm still getting paid the same, because I'm still getting paid my full-time hours, because that's what the hospital is doing for us. So they're very, very supportive, and I just love it.
Clap it up. I mean, you guys are the real heroes, and, you know, it's great. Like, in this is such a crazy time, because, like, nobody thought that this is what 2020 had in store for us. Like,
right.
2019 was a great closing out of the decade, and, like, I know, just talking to you in passing, like, man, we had so many things, you know, set up and in store for 2020. Like, one, you know, we had talked about, like, man, I wanted to get to just one film festival this year. And you got a chance to, like, go to, like, the granddaddy of them all. And I'm so thankful that you did that before the coronavirus, you know, was, like, really a thing that, unfortunately, that we took seriously way too late.
Right.
So you got a chance to go to Sundance.
Yes!
Like, that is nuts. Like, that is, you know, I mean, between Sundance and Cannes and, you know, Tribeca and, you know, like, a couple of, like, that's, in my opinion, that's the big one.
Yeah. Oh, man, I loved it. I had the time of my life. I'm very grateful that I was able to go. I was allowed to go, and I appreciate all the films I had the opportunity to watch and so, but I think what I took from the festival itself was the networking. Everybody I was able to meet, people I interact with on a daily basis on social media, and the people I was able to stay with, my roommates, oh my God, they were so amazing. They were very supportive, and they literally took me under their wing and helped me navigate the festival. Without them, I would have not been able to get through any of that. And I'm a very spoiled person for several reasons. One of them being I'm a Cali girl, so I'm used to my sunshine. I'm used to getting...
I'm about to be like, yo, because I know it was cold.
Yes! So you throw a little Cali girl over there in the snow, and I'm like, what is this? I was like Jack Skellington when he goes into the Christmas, like, what's this?
Snow? I think it's snow.
I think it's snow. but I had a blast. I loved it. I loved every single day of it, and oh my God, I hope I can go back there and just do it again.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that we have festivals to come, you know. I hope that we have not more leadership, but just like a modicum of leadership to kind of like really direct the nation in the way that we should move, not only logically, you know, but like compassionately. Mm-hmm. You know, this is something that nobody could have foreseen. Well, I guess people have, but like we are where we are, right? And you know, correct. Obviously both of us, we love movies, and like it's been hard on me because you know you know my schedule. I'm at the movie theater like 4 to 5 times a week,
so yes, like, you are.
I've got the itch, like I just want to, like I want to be on like that leather. I want to smell the movie theater popcorn. I want to hear the Dolby, like, you know, the track coming in, like it you stay marketing Dolby, but like literally that's all I watch, and you play it twice, like I'm already in the seat. You don't need to sell me on Dolby, I'm here. But like I miss it. I miss my local AMC. I miss like some of those. I miss Mark the ticket taker, man. Like that guy,
yeah, was,
you know, like that's my dude. And you know, yeah. I've got you know homies who run movie theaters, and everything is up in the air. Yeah. It's been crazy, like not having a traditional new theatrical release to do a review on. So it's mm-hmm. like we're trying to get creative, like with our content. And one, you haven't slowed down a bit, which shows like your professionalism and your consistency. But then also like it's crazy to like, what do you think? One, how have you been managing your movie time? Mm-hmm. And then what do you think is going to happen with movies going forward?
Oh, good question. My movie time. For me, because of everything that's going on, I've been able to watch more films. I'm trying to do some catch up on classic older films, trying to catch up on films that I was supposed to watch by now and haven't.
Yo, I've been paying attention. You've been like, yeah. When you say classic films, like for me, a classic film was like, you know, 1985, 1984. Yo, my girl is going back to like the 30s and 40s. What was the the oldest movie that you watched recently?
Oldest movie? Oh, I don't know if it's old. Well, a lot has to do with because I'm also doing school online, so I'm taking some film courses, and some of the classes require me to watch these older films. What's the oldest one I've seen? Just today I watched West Side Story, which is from 1961. It's still the 60s. I recently watched An On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. It was also good. Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, you've been going like deep.
Yeah.
One of the toughest things that I've had applying a critical lens when I'm watching a movie is understanding that movies are made specifically for the time that they were in. There were different styles of filmmaking, different styles of acting, the way that the stories were written were very much stylized for that time. And right. sometimes I find it tough to try to apply my lens when, like, I put on my critical brain, my critical brain, just, you know, only the past, like, you know, couple of years. How do you find that balance? Are you trying to assess the film quality wise the same way that you would compare it as if you're watching Marriage Story or watching, you know, Portrait of a Lady on Fire, or is it different?
It's slightly different. Luckily, because of the film courses and so, I somewhat have a grasp of what was going on at the time.
Okay.
Regarding to film history, not world history, although yeah. I do know a little bit about that too. But yeah, in regards to film, since I do have a little bit of a grasp of what was going on around that time and such, I do try to not be too critical about it or not let any outside either controversy or anything that was going on at that time. Like, I guess, I think the only example I can think of at the moment is On the Waterfront, with okay. the director having something to do, or something was going on at the time with the blacklist people and so on and so forth.
Gotcha. Okay. Was that Trumbo? Yeah. Did Trumbo do The Waterfront? That's the only person I really know from the blacklist.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I know there was a controversy with the director of the film, and I just try to let all that just put it aside. And I watched the movie first. The older movies, I have to watch them twice, to be honest with you.
Okay.
First time, I just watch it as a film fan and just try to get the grasp of it and try to say, okay, well, cool, whether I enjoyed it or not. And then the second time around, that's when I put my little critic hat on and I try to watch it differently and not be so judgmental, depending on the era or the year the film was made. But it's not easy. I can't watch, let's say, I don't know, It Happened One Night, with comparing it to Portrait of a Lady on Fire. They're two completely entirely different films made different eras and such, but it's not easy. But yeah, I do try to not be too judgmental about the older classic films.
I definitely feel like there has to be like a different approach. And I feel like I'm good at compartmentalizing, where like I just watched, and I get so much shit for this, but I just watched Scarface for the first time last week, right? Like, and this is a film
I haven't watched it, so don't feel bad.
Oh, damn! Great, then I don't feel that bad. Like,
we'll
I used to get
murdered.
I used to get so much crap because, like, one, I was born in Miami, so it's like, how you get out of Miami not watching Scarface? And then okay. I moved to New York when I was in the fourth grade, so it's like, bro, that's like literally the hip hop, you know, commandment. Like, thou must watch Scarface if living in New York in the 90s, right? And I just never got around to it, but like, it was so ingrained in pop culture, I felt like, oh, I know about it. Like, it's not like completely that to me. But then when I first watched the movie, it was weird because this film is made almost 40 years ago. And as a performer, as an actor first and foremost, I understand the different styles of acting, right? Where a lot of things that were back in the 80s, the 70s, and 60s were so much more presentational, where you were asked to be a little bit more bigger, even on a film set. And that's a lot, that's for a lot of technical reasons, right? And just like the certain styles of dialogue, they lent themselves to that. And just because it's different, one, it doesn't make it bad. Just understanding for like how those stories were packaged and were sold, like that's what the expectation was. I mean, you talk about with Marlon Brando, what he did, never seen the movie On the Waterfront, but I've seen acting scenes of it, and you would not see, you know, Brad Pitt performing in that same way today. And it doesn't mean that Brad Pitt's doing something better than what Marlon Brando was. It's just that's what the time was asking for it. So it's like, it's hard because, like, you know, we assess these number ratings and stuff like that, you know, to our reviews, and it's like, well, is this really the same when it's like, it's actually like quite different? It's really tough. And I don't think that there's like a rule or a standard for like every film that's like that, right?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. No. I completely agree with you. And you're coming at it through a completely different lens. Like you said, you're a performer yourself, so you know the different styles of acting and such. I don't. So It's interesting. Yeah, I do notice the different styles, the different type of filmmaking. I just recently, probably a few weeks ago, I just watched Citizen Kane for the first time. Ooh. And I was blown away by it. Just completely blown away. And then, like, ironically, I was doing this piece for In Their Own League. For Women's History Month on Dolores del Río, who was the first Mexican actress in the silent era. And I was doing research, and then I found out she ended up dating Orson Welles, and she was a major supporter and helped him a lot while he was making Citizen Kane. So so to just have those little pieces of nuggets just based on the research and so on and so forth, it was just fascinating. But yes, watching older films and just the different styles, the different types of acting and so on and so forth, it makes it a bit, it's hard, it's not easy. But yet again, exposing yourself to that type of art or the different kind of movies that they're out there, or the different types of films that were made back at that time, it helps us, I think. It helps us a lot, and it just enhances our form, our critical eye.
No, I'd absolutely agree. And I need to do a better job at kind of going back, because I think, you know, similarly what you're saying, I think there's a way of kind of like, one, there's a film appreciation to it that just as a film lover and as film critics, I think it's not essential, but I think it's admirable to introduce mm-hmm. yourself to those types of films. And it gives a good grounding and base, kind of like when you're taking, you know, these film classes. I remember, like, there was a tweet, you know, like a, I think like a month or so ago, that's like, oh, does a film critic need to go to film school, right? And I'm like, well, mm-hmm. that's like saying, like, does somebody who cooks well need to go to, like, chef school or stuff like that? Like, or somebody who, like, one, as an actor, you don't need to go to acting school. It's nice that you do, but there's people that I know that are tremendous actors and just have a God-given gift to perform. And one, I do not believe that you need a degree to be a film critic, in the same way that a filmmaker doesn't need a degree to be, you know, a filmmaker, right? But it definitely doesn't hurt, you know? It doesn't hurt taking those classes absolutely. And courses. I took like one or two at Los Angeles City College. That was mm-hmm. That was the only few classes that I took, and then I just ditched the rest of it. That was the only stuff that, like, particularly, you know, piqued my interest. But there was something that you had said that, like, I thought was super dope, and just the way that you've been going about your business. Obviously, you know, being Chicana and for, you know, growing up in East Los Angeles and having so much of your heritage impress upon you as a mm-hmm. woman, you've been really kind of pushing forward into celebrating your heritage just in the span of the film industry. Like, obviously you have your podcast that you're going to be doing with Catherine Gonzalez, Latinx Lens. What motivates you? Like, what motivated you to, like, really champion this podcast and to do what you're doing?
Okay. First of all, shout out to my girl, Catherine. Oh,
shout
my God.
Out!
Girl, I love you. She's amazing.
She's super duper dope.
Yeah, she is.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I gotta get her on too. So I'm gonna have you. That's my next goal, to try to be able to get her on as well.
Yeah.
Keep going.
Yes. Okay. So I'm gonna give you a little piece of nugget here, because I was saving a portion of this for episode one, which is still going to be in the episode, but I'm still going to give you a little exclusive content here. Yes, exclusive.
Yeah.
So as you know, I'm taking a film class right now. It's Race and Gender in American Film. And for week four, they had history of Asian Americans, Native Americans, and Latinos, Latinx, Hispanics in 1 week. So, and this was all throughout for film history as well. It's combined with television history as well. So for the textbook, they gave us a textbook. It's like 400 pages thick, and we have to read our chapters and so on and so forth. I was excited. I was beyond thrilled to learn about Latinx representation and their contribution to the industry in film and in television. And I start reading the textbook, and my enthusiasm and my excitement just disappears when I only read 2 pages on Hispanics, Latinx, and film history. This was a week or two after I'm bringing back Dolores del Río research I did, and she was just one actress back in the silent era. And I perhaps wrote more about her than this textbook had about our whole community contributing to the film industry. That broke my heart. And not only that, but thanks to that, the idea came to me. And I said, well, if these classes are not going to teach people what the Latinx community has done for film industry and for television, then I'm going to have to do it myself. And I'm not going to be the only one taking this course. There's going to be, I'm not the only one taking it at the moment. So prospective students are also going to be taking it. And there's been students that have graduated that have degrees that probably read the same page and a half or 2 pages of it. And technically it was 2 pages, but one, I'm saying page and a half, because half a page was a picture of the example of a Latin lover who was a stereotypical Hispanic Latinx representation on film. And it was, of course, Rudolph Valentino, who's not even Latino. So to me, it's a page and a half just of Latinx representation in TV and film. And that just sparked this flame in me. I was like, no, I have to do something about this. This is not right. This isn't fair. This isn't right. If film school is not going to teach me anything, then I'm going to have to go out there, let people know, and teach myself. Because there is no way we have only contributed a page and a half in the whole 100 years of film history. There's no freaking way. So thanks to that, I posted on Twitter, if I started this podcast, because I was taking the course, and this is not only for Latinos. Asian Americans had no more than 2 pages either. Native Americans only had 1 page. Yep. So, of course, I'm going to focus on my community. Mm-hmm. But it's unfortunate that a lot of minorities are still getting pretty much, like, literally, they're getting erased from the film books as well.
Yeah, it's frustrating. And, you know, I started up a podcast with Feeling Film, the Black Label, where I kind of felt like the same thing like you. And obviously there is more of a focus on African-American film history and representation, you know, on a more mainstream. And we are a very vocal minority. But at the same time, it does not exclude us from, like, being a part of the same group, or we're just getting scraps. And, you know, it's unfortunate, because while we have something like it sometimes frustrates me, probably the same way you felt, because having been born in Miami, where I have nothing but, like, Cubans around me, right? And then moving to New York, where I got Puerto Ricans and Dominicans, and then moving to Los Angeles, where I have, like, you know, Mexicans and Colombians and Venezuelans, like, all around. Every place that I've been, Hispanic and Latino culture has been so much impressed upon me. Like, so much so where, you know, most people think I'm Dominican when they first meet me. You know, like, no, I'm 100% Black. However, on my actor's resume, I am, you know, ethnic and ambiguous. So I can pull off whatever you need to be. You know, but it's definitely unfortunate that that's just how the sins of this country outside of Hollywood has deeply impressed upon how Hollywood has kind of unfairly made things very difficult, very oppressed us systematically, right? Like, some of the most famous Latinos that I know working in film is like Rita Moreno, and obviously Jennifer Lopez, and Carlos Mencia, not him, George Lopez and stuff like that, right? And there's like these little pops, like, wow, these big stars. And there's more representation on TV, and for the longest time I didn't understand why. And then I started digging deeper, started asking. It's really money, right?
Right.
The belief that, well, if we're making this film primarily with, you know, Latinos and Latinx people behind the camera and in front of the camera, right? it's going to be marketed to like that audience. Well, that audience doesn't go to the movie theater, right? They just watch TV. So there's more content that's catered to TV. But I'm like, yes, but if you do not give them content in the theater, they're never going to switch up. like there has to be that initiative to do that more. And, you know, sometimes I'm like, Mom, remember that there was a film that came out last year? I think El Chicano.
Yes.
And I didn't get a chance to see it because it had such a small release. Like, I wanted to watch it because, like, one, I love superhero anything, right? And, you know, the only Latino characters that I've seen, like, is, like, Blue Beetle, you know, in the, like, DC comics and stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Or,
which was a pretty good adaptation inside of Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., was, you know, dealing with Ghost Rider. Like, it was such a cool, you know, unique translation to kind of have that Robbie Reyes character, right? And when I saw El Chicano, I'm like, you know, I think actually George Lopez was, like, one of the producers on the film. But then there was, like, this controversy, like, well, one, a lot of Hispanics and Latinos didn't like it, and it just, like, nobody went to see it. And I did not understand. Like, one, it was hard for me to find it, but you saw it, right?
I did see it. I did not like it.
and it's weird because, like, I feel like, and I wonder if you feel the same, sometimes I feel like as a black film critic, mm-hmm. I'm put in this really tough place in regards to my support, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm like, well, am I supposed to like it's almost like my duty to like it, regardless of like what it is. Because if I don't, then we're not gonna get any more of it.
Yes, and that's one of the things we're really focusing on the podcast too. I'm gonna go a bit off tangent, but I'm gonna wrap it up nicely, I promise. The whole podcast is, the purpose of the whole podcast is to highlight actors and highlight filmmakers that have contributed to the film industry from the past, the present, and so on. But as well as to talk about things, about topics from our lens, from the Latinx lens. We want to talk about stereotypes. We want to talk about why these stereotypes continue to happen. And the Chicano, to me, was just that. It was just full of stereotypes. And which is why I didn't like the film. I was extremely excited. And we also want to talk about why, as critics or film reviewers of color or film reviewers of any minority groups, we have this set of, I don't want to say standards, but we come with extra baggage. Mm-hmm. If you, El Chicano is a perfect example. If you don't like this film, then they're not going to make anything more of us, supposedly of us, even though majority of us are not like the people being portrayed in this film. And also, unfortunately for me, I watched the remake of Overboard with Eugenio Derbez and Anna Faris. One of the two people, or maybe the only person, that thoroughly enjoyed it, because I was watching it differently, and I also get criticized for liking a film like that. So why do we have this extra baggage of having to like or having to automatically support a film? I understand we have to watch it, we have to support it, otherwise they're not gonna make anymore.
Yeah.
But when we come to criticize it, or when we come to support it or embrace it, we also have this extra pressure over us. To either, I got a lot, and I kid you not, a lot of hate when I gave a negative review of Roma. You have no idea how much hate I got. And I don't know, it's unfortunate that we, even though our voices are not as amplified out there, majority of the critics are white, and yet we're still trying to get out there, we're still trying to put our voices out there. But when we do, we get criticized for saying our genuine thoughts on the film. And I think it's unfortunate.
It's an absolute tough spot. And I felt it too, like, you know, in, especially in 2019, where one, like, as critics, it's like when a non-white film comes out, and we align to it, we're almost looked at. They're like, oh, so what did you think, Kobe? Huh?
Yes.
I'm like, oh, so that, Madea family funeral and little and, you know, what men want. What did you think of it? And it's a weird spot because I do get those tweets. I do get those kind of social interactions where folks generally want to know what I think first. And it's weird because, like, if I dislike a film, sometimes I'll get those raised eyebrows. And then from my own community, I'll sometimes feel it more. And it's a really weird place to be at because I didn't go to school for this, but like, I know my shit, right? And like, I know what makes a good film, and I say this all the time, I'm the most subjectively objective film critic. I believe that there's more subjectivity to film than there is objectivity to film because it's all based on your perspective.
Yes.
For the longest time, we've been taught that the films that we see is accurate to life. Like, that's how we perceive it because that's right. What we see on the big screen and the small screen. The thing is, the bulk of that perspective is from a white lens. So
correct.
We had white storytellers say, this is what black is, and this is how we show you on TV, right?
Mm-hmm.
We show thugs and athletes and stuff. So that's what you associate as black. If I give you content that's different than that, then subconsciously, you have some audience to say, that's not black enough. You even have black audiences say that that's not black enough. I can imagine in your community, oh, that's not brown enough, right?
Right.
And it's whack that that's what it's become. And I don't have the exact cure for it, but all I know that needs to happen is more positive representations. And when I mean positive, not just like, oh, let's completely, you know, like change it. We need to break those stigmas, right?
Yeah.
I watched The Photograph this year with Issa Rae and Lakeith Stanfield, and it was kind of like, you know, one of my few viral moments that I had. Like, I made this really big tweet, and I just said, I'm so excited for this film. Because this is a film that I haven't seen in a while that is a black love story that's starring two black leads, and the film, from what it's shown to me, is not about their blackness, right? It's just these two people, and they just so happen to be black. And I mean, the director, the writer, and the stars of the film, they all retweeted my tweet, and like, it was really, really dope. And like, I really wanted that film to do something special, and it did for me. Like, I loved it. It's in my top five of the year. Yet it made no money because how I took it, the audiences in which this film was catered for, I legit had people say, it just wasn't interesting because we've been taught that these black characters have to be cartoon characters. They're supposed to be big and boisterous and that's just what we've seen, right? You know,
right.
You spoke about, you know, what's the actor inside of Overboard? Eugenio Derbez, right?
Oh, I know
this
that
guy,
best, yeah.
He is working his ass off.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, I don't want to say he's kind of being pigeonholed or like being put in a corner, but he's almost like a cartoon character of what we've been told that Latino men are on screen.
Yep.
And the thing is, it's kind of like what Robert Townsend had going on in the 80s. Well, I can either choose to take some work or not work at all, right?
Yes.
And he's, you know, it's tough because some of his films, like, they don't sell great, but I feel like when he's called to kind of do that Eugenio Derbez thing, like when he did it in Dora, right? You know, it's like, oh, that's palatable because, like, that's what you're supposed to be. Because that's what white people said you're supposed to be. And it shouldn't be like that, right?
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I think one of the ways to change this is to have these films made and told and written by people of color.
Yeah.
And have these stories told from our lens, pretty much. And it's unfortunate because you have like the three amigos and the directors with Cuarón and Iñárritu and Del Toro. Mm-hmm. And they go out there and they're doing their thing. They're doing Gravity, they're doing Birdman, they're doing a lot of different stuff, and they get recognized for it. They all have Oscars. They're very like credible men. They're very admirable. But then you have another group of people saying, well, use your prestige, use your power to help the community out. And they're like, no, we want to step out of the box. We want to do our own different thing. And same thing. They get criticized for it, and then they get criticized for doing it, they get criticized for not doing it.
It's a damned if you do, damned if you
don't.
It's a
double-edged friggin' sword. It's unfortunate. But
I remember saying that same lament. Like, I remember last year, I was kind of, I think after the Chicano thing, right? Mm-hmm. I was kind of getting frustrated because, like, I was seeing so much less Latino and Latinx representation on film. I'm like, well, maybe it's time that the talent steps up and does something for the, but like, that's hard, right? Like, I'm an actor, I'm an actor. Like, I should not have to wear the hat of producer. I shouldn't have to wear the hat of writer unless I feel called to do that. Mm-hmm. How much of a burden do we put on the community to say, okay, if I'm Eva Longoria, I've had the successful, you know, television and film career, now I need to go, not saying out of my way, but I need to pay it forward by carving out something of my time and my money to make a pathway for others. Now, that's an admirable thing, but that shouldn't be forced on somebody. Like, that, if it's in your heart, do it. But if it's not, they shouldn't get shit for it. And I think that I was being a little bit, like, I want to say mean, because I'm generally not mean, but like, I was like, yo, I feel like you need to do that. But then, like, I had to check myself, like, nah, Kobe, like, if it's in their heart to do it, then they should do it. But if it's not, I'm not gonna shit on Guillermo for, like, not saying, like, hey, I'm gonna open up a school that is strictly for, you know, Hispanic and Latino filmmakers, and go to school for free because we need you to tell the stories that Hollywood's afraid to tell. Like, that's great in theory, but if that's not on his heart, then, like, we shouldn't give him shit for that, you know?
Exactly.
But there should be those programs available. Like, there should be. And I challenge those who have that heart, like, that's what they need to do.
Yeah. And I think a lot, like you said, I've also been seeing less and less representation on screen from the Latinx community. And I think a lot has to do with, of course, television. There's an increase in TV representation, but a lot of the actors themselves have, some of them, not a lot, I'm not giving, like, any stats or anything, but some of them do refuse to portray stereotypical roles. And every now and then you get one actor or one actress that can get in there and somehow portray a character without that character acknowledging the background. Rita Moreno was one of them. Raul Julia was another one too. And right now, the only person I personally can think of is Oscar Isaac, who's doing that as well. And, you know, it's very, very, very few of them who are able to do that. But, oh man, it's rough.
It is.
It's not easy.
And then I'll say also, like, in our space, I think I want to see more critics of color in these underrepresented groups to step up forward, and, you know, for a lot of these bigger, like, publications and outlets to make way for that. Because, like, one, I think that makes you a more inclusive and makes your criticism of film better, right? I was so frustrated with the Oscars this past year because
it was like,
well, you've made up in your mind what you choose to see, right? Mm-hmm. And because of your background and your, you know, in probably a lot of subconscious biases, you haven't allowed to really, like, open the spectrum of what is a good film because you just refuse to see some of these films, right?
Right.
And if you make that, how do you really know what a good film is? How do you know that you're a good critic when you've limited your scope of what you see so much? And it was very apparent when you see so many films look like so many films that came before it, or filmmakers that look like they all are in this one group. And, you know, so it's tough. So, I mean, I challenge any person out there, just like how Rosa was just a couple of years ago, just say, I love movies. I love talking about movies. Yeah. And while it was not like from when I was a kid, I'm going to dream to be a film critic. I don't think anybody's dreaming to ever be a film critic. We got to just, like, fall into it. But, like, somebody said that you should give it a try. And that trial turned into, like, this passionate, like, yo, your passion is, like, super duper bright. And, like, I'm proud to be your friend. I'm proud to be, like, your colleague, and now collaborating with you on this podcast and hopefully future podcasts to come. And yeah, like, this conversation is everything that I wanted. Like, it's dope talking to myself, but it's even more incredible when I have someone to bounce my thoughts off of, because yeah. One, and for the people out there to kind of like, you know, this is, I'll show you how the sausage is made. This is not scripted anyway. None of these questions have been like marked down. It's just, I'm inspired by this conversation and finding the best way to steer it to be something that's fruitful for people to think of film and cinema and the way how it impresses upon us differently. I mean, I love movies. I love going to the movies, but also I love what movies do to us. How does it change us? How does it inspire us? How does it make us do things better, not only for ourselves, but for the people around us? And it's going to be tough these next 3, 6, 12 months. I've got no idea what's in store in the landscape, but knowing that there's people like Rosa out there that makes it like enjoyable and makes it communal and makes it positive, like, I thank you. I'm like, you can't see, but I'm bowing to you right now. And I'm so appreciative of you, and thank you for coming on. Please let the people know what else you got going on one more time and where they can find you.
You can't see it, but I'm literally crying right now. No, thank you for everything you just said. And just to slightly piggyback on what you just said, yes, if you're a person of color and you love talking about film, we need your voices out there, because we can sit here and talk all we want about filmmaking and not there being a lot of films representing us. But if the critics watching these films, giving these films a Rotten Tomato score, are only white critics, then we're really not helping the cause. So let's just talk. Let's just voice our opinions and let's just go and do and watch films and just love to talk about them. I'm crying. I can't get my thoughts together right now. I'm so sorry.
You are good, chica. But make sure to visit.
But like you said,
yes,
not
visit
scripted.
Rosa's website. Make sure you read her review. She's got a lot of dope stuff out right now. Like one, she just got finished doing her Invisible Man review not too long ago, which is really if you haven't seen Invisible Man, all right, there's a couple movies out for 1999 that you should watch. One, see Troll Tour. All right, Invisible Man is worth it. The Hunt, I don't think is. You can save your money on that. Real quick for the people, I will ask you, what's in your personal queue that you got that you're watching that you can make recommendations for?
Oh my gosh. I guess what's on Hulu right now, probably for me, though, the first one would be Portrayal of a Lady on Fire. Oh my.
Yeah. You saw that movie like what? How many times? Like 4, 5, 6 times?
I have lost count. I've seen it too many times. It was my favorite film of last year. And I just love that film. I wasn't the biggest fan of Parasite, but if you guys have been wondering what the big fuzz is all about, it's a good film. Just not one of my tops personally.
Let me add on right now. So Rosa and I, for the longest time, were movie twins. Like, we found ourselves so much thinking alike in the way that we rated and reviewed films. It was really eerie, because like, we didn't like exchange it at all beforehand or nothing. It's like she's in LA, so she's seeing a bunch of stuff before me, and then like a few days later or a week later, I'm like, this is my thing, because I generally, let me tell you something, I will like and retweet everything you put out, but I'll wait to read it until I've already kind of said my piece on it, and then I'm like, oh, there we go again. And like every now and then we'll be like on the opposite sides of a particular film, but for the most part, yeah, we're twinning a lot.
Yes, we are.
Yeah, but definitely make sure to check out her site. It's rosasreviews.net. Make sure that you are following her. She's one of the dopest follows out there. You'll see her beautiful face. She's got these nice cute glasses on there. She just did a tweet earlier where she's 20 years old. She still looks the same. She's like, she practices witchcraft and stuff like that. But you can follow her on Twitter at Rosas Reviews. RosasReviews. She's got the Latinx Lens at Latinx Lens coming soon. And of course, she's the editor at in their own league at their, THEIR for our vocabulary folks, their league. And she's one of the dopest people I know. And yo, once again, thank you. Gracias. Appreciate you so much. Love you, girl. Thank you for being on.
No, thank you for inviting me. I am honored and I had a freaking blast. I loved it. So thank you for having me. Loved it.
Can't wait to be able to have you on again. And for those that are out there listening, remember when they ask you where you heard it from, you tell them Kobe told me. Peace.